Hi again, everyone. It's Ting Tarvi, Palliative Care Reg at BHRUT, and I have Claire Bates, our Clinical Lead and Consultant, with us today. And today we're doing part two of Do You Want to Live on DNA CPR? We've got a little disclaimer. This is going to be a slightly longer episode than usual. We tried a million times to try and get it under 10 minutes, but it is impossible. And also because we want to make sure it's useful. We didn't want that to be at the expense of, you know, trying to slim it down too much. So just going back, last week in part one, we covered the underlying principles and the legal duties, which is a really important foundation before you move on to this one. So we'd encourage you to listen to that first. But today we're going to focus on the communication aspect and sort of how to have these conversations. And these can be really hard conversations for us, for patients and family. And that's been amplified by the pandemic, like the PPE getting in the way, clinical urgency. And, you know, it really is important to highlight that having these conversations ideally in a timely way outside of the pressure of needing a decision like right there and then would be really beneficial.
And it's also worth saying, isn't it, Ting, that we sometimes make this harder for ourselves than it needs to be by inadvertently saying things that dig holes that are then difficult to get out of. And we're going to try in this episode to give some tips about how to avoid those holes. Yeah. Good. So why don't we start off by you talking a bit about why these conversations do sometimes go wrong.
Yeah, and I think that one of the main reasons is that we're not recognising the types of skills and competencies that we need before we dive into these conversations. So I think there are two components. There's the clinical knowledge and then there's the communication skills. And oftentimes I think we've got the clinical knowledge, we've made a decision that we and the team are confident in. But then we underestimate the need for good communication skills, which are often thought of as, inverted commas, a soft skill. And sometimes we think our clinical know-how is just going to carry us through a conversation like this and we can just plow on. But that can be very unwise and lead to tricky conversations. Mm. And so after assessing our own skill set and where our gaps might be, the next thing is also to recognise what kind of conversation we're having.
Yeah, so there are three main scenarios where you would have a DNA CPR sort of situation. Sometimes patients make it really easy for us by making it very clear that actually they don't want to be resuscitated in the event of an arrest. At the other end of the spectrum, it's very clear sometimes to medical teams and multidisciplinary teams that it would be totally the wrong thing to do to try and resuscitate this person because their arrest is actually an anticipated terminal event in the context of their overall medical frailty or progressive life-limiting illness. So those are the kind of two extremes. But in the middle, you have this sort of grey area where actually it may be completely right to attempt to resuscitate someone, but you might need to check out what their view is about it, because actually their view may swing it one way or the other, that you actually may end up saying this wouldn't be a CPR attempt. And that's a shared decision-making conversation rather than an information-giving conversation. So I guess that's one of the things we really want to try and get across in this episode, is that if the medical team are very sure that this is not appropriate to offer attempted CPR, that then the conversation that needs to happen is really a breaking bad news conversation where information is being given, as opposed to a shared decision-making conversation where together the professionals and the patient are going to try and decide what is the right thing to do.
So now we're going to talk through kind of the steps to work through and when you're delivering or breaking bad news. So I think first up, we're going to talk about good setup.
So who needs to be there for this conversation? It's not the kind of thing to do on the fly when, you know, it's a kind of afterthought at the end of a ward round. Like, you know, this is a significant conversation, breaking bad news. So you might want to get a relative up, or at least on a video call, and perhaps have a nurse or another member of the team with you for the conversation. And then the absolute key next step, rather than, I mean, often we just rush in because we want to give the information. But we've said before in our episode on the principles of good communication that you have to stop and listen first. And so there needs to be some information gathering. So, you know, what, asking the patient, what have you been told already about your condition? What are your expectations when you look to the future? Are you worried about your health? Those kind of questions to try and get a sense of, does this person realise how ill they are and what the aims and goals of treatment are now for them?
And that will really help you to pitch the rest of your conversation, the level of details they may or may not need. And then that allows you to tailor your warning shot as well.
Yeah, so warning shots are so important because they give people a kind of advance, they give them time to prepare that something is coming that could be difficult. And so that's usually the sort of thing that I was saying, I need to have a conversation with you that may be difficult to have. Or it may be that from what they've said already, you say, well, actually, what I need to tell you now won't come as a surprise to you. But for some people, this can be a distressing conversation. So you're just going to give a shot. Warning shot across the bow, something difficult is coming that's serious, we need to talk about.
Yeah. And another way in which links back to our previous episode was, actually sometimes it's explaining, I actually have a legal duty to cover, what's coming up next. And I acknowledge, though, that it's going to be a bit of a difficult conversation for some people.
Yeah, exactly. So then when you get into giving information, again, most people have heard phrases like chunk and check, so don't do a long monologue, but just give small amounts of information, check how it's going down, how it's landing, clear language, not jargon. So how do we explain that there are some things that are appropriate and some things that aren't? So I do use the phrase, we have reached the limit of what medicine can offer, but in terms of what would actually work in your situation. So just acknowledging that not everything is possible.
Yeah.
And then there's another phrase that we've also heard that we like and use sometimes, which is just this idea about whether your heart is the first thing to go or the last thing to go. So in the context of someone who's otherwise fairly well, has a big heart attack, their heart is the first thing to go, and so there's a good chance that resuscitation will be successful. But if you've got someone who's got other very serious kind of things wrong with them, the heart would be the last thing to go in the context of their advancing progressive illness, then obviously the chances of recovery are virtually nil in that situation.
And in that context, I've found sometimes it's really useful to talk about allowing a natural death. And usually when patients and family think about their last days and their dying moments, it's comfortable, peaceful, surrounded by family. They're not imagining someone jumping on top of them, trying to resuscitate them. So trying to explain that we're allowing a natural and, at this stage, inevitable process to happen, but doing that in a as dignified and as comfortable a way as possible.
Yeah, and I think it really helps, actually, if we're saying that we can't do this, that we can also at the same time say, but we can do this. And so this relates to the idea that we don't want people to think there's nothing more that we can do, because there's always something more that we can do. But that something more is really good palliative care that's focused around their symptoms, their quality of life, the environment that they're being cared for in, what their priorities are going forward. So I would always try in a conversation like this to bring something kind of positive.
Yeah.
That rather than just saying we're not doing this.
Yeah, and I think that also really ties into all the stuff we discussed about the individualised end-of-life care plan and how that is supporting good holistic care, and it highlights, all the things that we can do to ensure comfort and that people don't feel abandoned, like there's nothing left.
Yeah, so speaking of how people are feeling, I guess that leads into the just at the end of that conversation that you might want to just check in, how does this leave you feeling? Mm-hmm. Now that I've told you this, how are you feeling about that? I guess there are some things that would be really unhelpful to say during the conversation. Should we just kind of go through some of those?
Yeah, because I think sometimes it's really useful to hear what not to do, and then that really highlights the right things to do. So I think the really important thing is this is a breaking bad news situation, so we're giving information and we're not necessarily asking for someone's opinion on this. Yeah. And so in that scenario, using questions like would you like resuscitation or would you like CPR are really unhelpful. Yeah. And that kind of is what brought us to the original title, because that reads as do you want to live, and for most people then they're like, well, yeah, I do. So yes, I do want CPR. And then another thing that has been, well, can lead you into a tricky spot is saying, oh, I don't think resuscitation is going to be in your best interests. And again, for a lot of people, that reads as, well, I think living is in my best interests and not dying, actually. So I don't agree with you there. Yeah. So be very careful about the words you choose to describe your decisions.
Yeah. And perhaps at the end, in the same way that we've just said, you might check in, how are you feeling about that? That what you wouldn't say is, are you okay with what I've just said?
Yeah.
Because, you know,
they're
not going to be okay about it. I mean, some people will be, but that almost kind of suggests that you're looking for their consent or their opinion about it. So again, this is why it's so careful to choose your words carefully.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And so after this, you've done your amazing comm skills and you've delivered the unfortunate bad news, but you've done the best you can, and the patient turns around and says, yeah, thanks doctor, I totally hear you, but I completely disagree.
Yeah, I want to be resuscitated.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes. So what do we do when that happens? Well, I think for me, what I would then do is go back to the information gathering part of the conversation. So I'd want to dig down a bit deeper into, you know, what are you hoping for? Mm-hmm. Like, kind of, you know, what is your expectation of resuscitation? Yeah. Like, what do you think the chances are of it being a successful treatment for you? So you go back to the beginning of the conversation to be really sure whether we are on the same page or not about where this kind of person is in their disease trajectory. And I mean, we've just got to work really hard to try and get consensus as much as we can. And if we really can't, then we should be offering second opinions.
Yeah.
And there's different ways of doing that. I mean, certainly within the trust, like, consultant colleagues act as second opinions all the time on, you know, on challenging cases or places where we haven't reached consensus.
And I think just, like, don't feel alone. And even in the middle of the night, there is always going to be 24/7 support from various teams, whether that is your consultant on call or palliative care support, we're available 24/7, critical care 24/7. It's not a decision that needs to be borne by one person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, sorry about documenting. Just sorry, very quickly. So if obviously completing your DNA CPR forms, but if somebody is in disagreement with a decision, then by all means, document that and highlight that. But just remember that at the end of the day, it is a medical decision.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we talk then about people who lack capacity, just to kind of wrap up this episode?
Yeah. And I think the important thing here is that the principles are all still the same. And so we kind of realised that it mirrors the scenarios that we talked about at the beginning. So there might well be patients that already have an advanced decision to refuse treatment, including life-sustaining treatment, i.e. CPR, and that's synonymous to your patient that had capacity but doesn't want the CPR.
So they've made their wishes clear in advance,
which would make everybody's life a bit easier.
Yeah.
And then there was that end of the spectrum where we need to make a medical decision again, and it is clear that it is not going to be of overall benefit for this person to have CPR. And then it's a case of, again, breaking bad news and using those same skills, but with the next of kin instead. And then that grey area where it may work and it may be the right thing to offer, but we need to take into account that person's wishes and values. And as they can no longer tell us what they are, we might well seek the opinion of the lasting power of attorney, if there is one, or next of kin to help us inform that decision.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the same way that you wouldn't ask a patient, do you want CPR if it's not appropriate, you wouldn't ask a family, what do you want to do? And I think it's really important to make sure the family don't feel that any burden of decision-making kind of sits with them, because that's a heavy weight to bear, especially after the person dies.
Yeah.
So, Good. And what about the resources that are on offer within the trust? Because we've done a whistle-stop tour through this. Where can people find out more information?
So on the intranet, there is the trust guidelines, the title being...
Well, it's a DNA CPR policy, which I understand is being reviewed because it's not quite up to date, but there's some really good stuff in there. Mm-hmm. So look at it, read it, and get excited about when the new one comes out.
And for patients as well, there is information leaflets. So there's one that is literally called Let's Talk About CPR. So that might be something that you could follow up your conversation with, giving the resources out to patients and family.
Great. Well, I hope that's been useful to those of you listening. I guess the main takeaways we wanted to get across in these two episodes are that DNA CPR is always a medical decision. Now, in the context of palliative care, it's our legal obligation to inform patients and their families of the decision that the medical team has made for a DNA CPR. And the way to approach that is very much as a breaking bad news type conversation. That's very different to a shared decision-making conversation where the doctor and the patient are trying to decide together what is the right thing to do. And in that context, we would be asking for the patient's view about resuscitation. So hopefully that's cleared that up. Thank you for listening. Bye.